then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's November the 21st, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. The first thing I'd like to do this week is to thank everyone who was involved in putting together a great meeting we had down in Oregon this weekend between our Oregon and Washington comrades, some of whom I was meeting for the first time. I'd like to thank everyone who came, and especially the lady who did most of the organizing and the married couple who were our hosts. Already this week, I'm starting to see some positive results from that get-together. Thank you all again. Next up, I have been asked to comment on the Craig Cobb fiasco in North Dakota. I will not do so as far as specific details go, lest I sin against that mythical white unity, which has in fact never existed at all in our movement, but I will philosophize a little on a subject which fascinates me, and I'm sure some other people as well. Just what is with these guys? Every few years, some clown manages to jump in front of the TV cameras, claiming to be the big white supremacist guru or the new Führer or whatever, and he does something like this. The worst was the Jew Andrew Greenbaum back around the turn of the century. I have seen so many Craig Cobbs down through the years that I could practically have written out this script in advance, and every time it happens, I'm intrigued and puzzled by one of the great historical mysteries of our tiny little movement. Are these turkeys just exhibitionist morons who will do anything at all to have those TV cameras turned on them? Or are they something more? In other words, is somebody arranging all this? Is somebody paying people like this to run around in public and show their butts and deliberately make us all look foolish and weak? Yes, I know that sounds paranoid, but every time it happens, the same stupid shit is involved and the same kind of dysfunctional behavior is displayed until the conclusion that there's something going on here behind the scenes becomes more and more irresistible. Every time is like a repeat of the last time. The media suddenly discovers a clown, and for no reason anyone can explain, all of a sudden he's front page or front website these days. The clown dances and capers for a while, sometimes wearing a costume, and doing other things that make not just him but our entire cause look very silly, and then he bursts into flames or he self-destructs in some other spectacular way. Time after time I have seen this happen, every few years, and the pattern is such that sometimes the conviction becomes overwhelming to me that it's got to be deliberate. Public behavior of a kind guaranteed to make people stay away from us in droves, not only to make us look violent and scary, which the media does as well sometimes, but to make us look weak and silly and foolish, all that stuff keeps normal people away just as effectively. Now, I swear to God, it's almost like these incidents are deliberately planned to turn white racial consciousness and any attempt to resist into a joke in our own people's minds. Either that, or we are depicted as criminals, and that's one reason why we have such difficulty attracting normal people. Normal people don't want to be associated with petty criminals or with a joke. Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said that there is never any such thing as coincidence in politics, and you should always look for cui bono, who benefits. Of course, all of this is beyond proof with the resources we have available to us now. I'm pretty sure that when someone is finally able to open the secret files of the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center, we will find a list of secret bank accounts and wire transfers, and I think some of the names on those accounts will surprise us. People, on a broader note, this Craig Cobb thing has brought out the need for the Northwest Front more than ever before. We simply cannot leave the fate of our race in the hands of yo-yos like this. The problem is largely one of self-appointment. Anybody with a good spiel and a wild look in his eye can stand up and say, I'm for the white race of people, and all of a sudden he's considered to be one of us and covered with some kind of invisible blanket of immunity, which prevents all criticism and any critical and skeptical examination of this individual and what he says and what he's doing. There has to be some kind of authority in the white movement, even if it's only moral authority. There has to be somebody who is generally recognized to be in a position to pass judgment on what is legitimate and what is not, what is productive and what is not, and who is one of us and who is not. Now, I will admit that for many years the National Alliance fulfilled this purpose. I am not really proposing that the Northwest Front assume that role in the movement, but frankly, there seems to be a certain inevitability about it because, people, let's be honest here. Come on now. I think everybody listening to this knows that we're the best thing going in the movement right now. And unfortunately, that means we're going to have to take the lead in this matter as in certain others, which I won't get into right now. Anyway, the media, of course, love the Craig Cobb types because they fit the stereotype. One of the reasons that I don't get the Craig Cobb treatment myself, and the Northwest Front is blacked out, is that we don't fit the stereotype. We have actual ideas and articulate material like the Northwest novels and our Constitution and this podcast, as crude as some of it is. The media will not allow white people to know that there are indeed intelligent, articulate, and committed white nationalists out there who have the solution. And yes, we have the solution. People, we are desperately trying to build a legitimate white resistance movement here in the Northwest, something that is not a joke. Imagine that. A for real white resistance group that is not a joke. Wow, what a concept. What a fantastic vision, almost like something out of Lord of the Rings. A real white revolutionary party. Far out, man. I need your help to do this, and this kind of segues into something I was talking about last week. Our hits on northwestfront.org are still down. Not all gone. We're still getting many thousands of unique visits every week, especially around Wednesdays and Thursdays when Radio Free Northwest is due up. But I go down the list on our stat counter here, and I look at each visit, and I see no referring link, no referring link, no referring link, time after time. This means that people are coming here directly instead of from links posted elsewhere around the internet. They've got us bookmarked, or else they just type in the northwestfront.org into their browser. Okay, not all of them. There are still a few hits coming from links. I won't say where in view of who's listening to these podcasts, but nowhere near as many as there were 2 months ago. I'm also encouraged to see that we're getting a fair number of hits from Google searches. In other words, somebody heard of the party somewhere and they came looking for us, which is a very good sign. But I am convinced more than ever that about 2 months ago, somebody did a cleanse or a purge or whatever you want to call it and removed most, if not all, of the links to northwestfront.org that had been stuck up all over the internet. Possibly it was one of those Israeli gigs we've seen referred to in the media, but whoever it was, they seem to have done an effective job, and there is a drop in our hits. Not catastrophic by any means, but noticeable. And I want to get those numbers back up and keep them moving up. Guys, regardless of my doubts about the internet, and regardless of my reservations about the psychological effects on you of working for us on the internet, i.e. a night of surfing and hopefully posting as well gives you the idea that you've done your duty to the Republic by clicking a mouse and not by packing a moving van. Anyway, you know what I said last week. Regardless of all that, I have to admit we need the help. Please, get out there and post that link and do everything you can to bring people to our website. There are millions of white people out there who desperately want to hear what the party has to say. They just don't know it yet because no one has dragged them kicking and screaming to northwestfront.org or northwestfront.net. No one has shoved a Northwest novel under their nose. Most white people, those millions of white people who want to hear what we have to say, don't know that we're here. If we're not careful, they're going to go through their whole lives never knowing that we, who had the answers, are here. The Northwest Front is blacklisted and blacked out by the media, and we have to break through the blackout. We need your help, guys. Now here's Lord Lucan.
This message is about believing in lies. First, what is God's opinion on people who believe in lies? The answer to that can be found in the book of Genesis. God said, "Do not eat from the forbidden fruit. If you do, you will die." But Adam said, "The woman that you gave me some to eat. We were told by a snake that we would become like God, knowing good from evil, if we ate." So did Adam and Eve become like God and live forever? So did God forgive them for being deceived, or did they die? Now let us suppose that your government tells you that the enemy is evil and wicked and deserves to be bombed out of existence. Would you believe them? Those Germans are evil and wicked, and they have a leader who is preaching the obvious, that Germans and other Nordics are the master race. They are also preaching the obvious that gypsies are lazy and that Jews practice an evil religion. Working class people hate lazy ass people, and they put up the sign, "Work shall make you free." Now a Greek philosopher said, "Question everything." Why? Because the ruling class lies. It lies or engages in propaganda so that the lower class will fight their wars for them. All the lower class will get for fighting wars for the rich is a shallow grave. The rich Jews will gain the benefit of your going to war on their behalf. Go and kill the side that is Christian. We are supporting the atheistic communists. Do not ask any questions. Obey the orders of your ruling class. And did Christian America and Christian England obey the order to kill and bomb other Christians? And if you are foolish enough to obey the lies of the ruling class, what is God's opinion on that? He said, "On the day of eating the forbidden fruit, you will die." The Second World War had nothing to do with racism. Germany had revived its economy by means of National Socialism. National Socialism abolished the immoral wealth of the bankers. The workers of Germany got paid in real money. The bankers could no longer sit about doing nothing, making money out of nothing, by means of interest. Racism was used by the ruling class to persuade the lower class to fight the Japs. The Japs were depicted as being squinty-eyed subhumans. The Germans were depicted as racists. Yet Americans could not figure out the absurdity of attacking one side as being racists and using racism to justify attacking the other side as propaganda. So what about now? Smedley Butler, a four-star Marine Corps general, wrote a book called War is a Racket. When the Allies retook Italy, they reestablished the mob takeover of that country, whereas Mussolini had put them out of business. When mobsters get elected, they practice cronyism. They use the law to cover up their crimes. Judges end up being on their payroll. It is now obvious that the Jewish mob runs America. But are you one of those foolish Americans who still believes that America is a free country and a democracy? About 98% of Americans opposed the banker bailout. But did politicians listen to the American people? Why is that we have politicians that ignore the public? Where are the politicians who would tell the truth? The people who elected the politicians listen to the lies they are being told. Did you know that the real unemployment in America is over 100 million? In America, they count only the people looking for work as being unemployed. They do not count the people who have given up looking for work. So why does the ruling class want even more immigrants? Because the power of the ruling class and the rich increases with the more unemployment that you have. National Socialist Germany abolished unemployment before the war broke out. Full employment empowers the working class. Labor is the true basis for wealth and not making money at interest. Germany had to be destroyed because it threatened the power of the ruling class. The economic success of Italy and Germany is the real reason for the war. The rich billionaires continue to make money, whereas the standard of living of the working class continues to fall. It is because you are still believing in lies. Millions upon millions died in the Second World War because they believed in lies. Part of England was occupied during the Second World War, the Channel Islands. I was 12 and with the Boy Scouts when I first learned the truth about Hitler. The National Socialist German Labour Party was a Labour Party. The farm boy who was showing us the underground hospital built by the Germans in the island of Guernsey said so. As a result of finding out that National Socialism was a Labour Party, the Channel Islands refused to establish a resistance movement. Why? Because they had been lied to. As is said by Clausewitz, war is politics by other means. America is the same as Australia. It is a swatocracy. Quote, unquote. We were here first. The land has all been taken. Now bugger off and go back to wherever you came from. America was a nation of immigrants. Was is past tense. It is time to start listening to the truth. If you cannot defend the land you were born in, then you do not deserve to have any. Evolution means survival of the fittest. If you are foolish enough to believe in lies, then you do not deserve to be a survivor now, do you? And God's opinion is the same. Now, in my next podcast, I will bring up the inability of Americans to understand Mein Kampf. As Winston Churchill said, the English and Americans are separated by a common language. Also, what is the correct strategy when dealing with people that believe in lies?
This week, one of our comrades in Romania sent us some very rare audio cuts from before and during World War II, specifically some music from the Romanian Iron Guard, also known as the Legion of the Archangel Michael. When we think of Jews in Eastern Europe, we generally think of shtetls in Poland and Russia and Lithuania, but they were, in fact, everywhere. In the Balkans, the Jews had been brought into the area as merchants, bankers, tax collectors, and Ottoman bureaucrats. The Turks seemed to think it was funny to put Jews in authority over Orthodox Christians, but the inhabitants of those countries never got the joke. At one stage before the war, the population of Romania was estimated to be one-third Jewish, and there is a very heavy Turkic strain still in some of the people there. No country suffered worse under Turkish rule than Romania, and as a result they became very strongly religious, so the Iron Guard used a lot of religious imagery. The Guard was founded in 1927 by Corneliu Codrianu. In 1933, they were banned by the then-liberal government of Romania, and there were mass arrests. A number of legionaries were also murdered by the police and communist thugs. In 1938, Codrianu himself was strangled in prison on the orders of the Romanian King Carol II at the instigation of his Jewish mistress, Magda Lupescu. And you need to bear in mind all these murders and all this bloodshed when dealing with the Iron Guard's history during World War II. To make a long story short, Romania is one of the few places where there was, for a short time, something approaching a real Holocaust, in that when the Legion was brought into the Romanian government in 1940 by Marshal Antonescu, the Guard pretty much went batshit and came after the Jews. Again, to make a long story short, there are to this day very few Jews remaining in Romania. They were either killed by the Iron Guard, or most of them were chased out of the country, and probably ended up in Brooklyn or Skokie, Illinois, whining about how they were so persecuted in the old country. As always, they brought it on themselves. If the Jews didn't want to be persecuted, their whore shouldn't have had Corneliu Codrianu murdered. Anyway, this Romanian comrade was able to send us some Iron Guard mellows that I've never heard before. This is the Legionary Hymn of Victory.
Oh,
Okay, now I'm going to play another clip from Dr. Revelo P. Oliver's famous speech to the National Convention of the John Birch Society in July of 1966. The speech which, in fact, got Dr. Oliver kicked out of the JBS because the candy man didn't like some of his ideas and damn sure didn't like Oliver stealing his thunder. I know this clip is rather long, 18 minutes and change, and the last segment for next week is almost as long, but this really is one of the best public addresses that any of our people has ever made, even if it was 47 years ago. And all of us today need to be familiar with it, if only to make sure we know who Dr. Oliver was, but also because even half a century later, it still rings true. Now, some speakers I wouldn't want to play for 18 minutes because I'd be afraid the short American attention span would kick in. But nobody's complained about these clips so far. Now, I understand from people who knew him that listening to Dr. Oliver in person was a fantastic experience. He was an old-fashioned academic trained in the classical techniques of Greek and Roman oratory, and he could hold a crowd like no one else.
The professional brainwashers in our colleges have tried to cover up that fact by inventing a phrase, the conspiratorial theory of history. A phrase which, of course, must be uttered with a quick giggle to prevent the audience from thinking about it. When so uttered, the phrase sticks so well that many young men who have risen above liberty, that is simply to ignore the indisputable fact that second only to foreign wars and invasions, political conspiracies are the principal causes of historical mutations. One could spend hours merely reciting the names of famous political conspiracies that have changed the course of history. A common type is what is often called the palace conspiracy, which normally results in the assassination of a despot or other important political figure. Typical examples are the assassination of the false Smerdis in Persia in the 6th century BC by the conspirators who placed Darius the Great on the throne. The assassination of Julius Caesar at the end of the Roman Republic. The assassinations of Caligula and many other emperors during the Roman Empire. The conspiracy that made Catherine the Great the ruler of Russia, and if you wish, the conspiracy that carried out the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. There is another type of conspiracy, the revolutionary conspiracy, which necessarily involves a much larger number of persons, normally a very large number of actual conspirators. Of such conspiracies, the history of the Greek states provide many examples. Everyone knows of the conspiracy headed by Catiline to burn and pillage Rome and enjoy a general massacre. Most people have heard of the great Jewish conspiracy of 117 to 118 AD, which extended across almost the whole of northern Africa and forced the imperial Roman Empire to recall its legions from farther Mesopotamia, almost shook the empire to its foundations. In such conspiracies, large numbers must necessarily participate. And while the conspirators very naturally try to keep their conspiracy secret and hidden until the moment they strike, they themselves know specifically what they plan to do. Catiline's followers, and there were thousands of them, must have known when they were recruited that their purpose was to burn and pillage and kill. Although naturally, they did not know all the details of their leader's plan. Now you could identify a third type of conspiracy, which, as I said a moment ago, has no historical example, no certain one at least, before the 9th century AD. That is the conspiracy that is based on mass deception. It is a secret society with grades of initiation and under the direction of a small inner circle whose members alone know its true purpose. The founder of the Bottini, for example, in the 9th century, had a sovereign contempt for the mass of his followers. He called them jackasses. His trusted emissaries were instructed to enlist recruits by professing whatever religious doctrine or national feeling was most likely to appeal to the jackasses in their territory. They, for example, in one place or another, professed every variety of Muslim cult, many non-Muslim cults, and philosophical atheism. They appealed to the anti-Arab sentiments of the Persians and to the anti-Persian sentiments of the Arabs. It was thus possible to set in motion and direct a vast multitude of men of the most diverse beliefs and nationalities, making them all work for an ultimate purpose that was known only to a little inner circle. And the conspiracy was highly successful. There is undoubtedly a conspiracy of some kind, and a powerful one. We know that there is the Bolshevik conspiracy at work. But our difficulty is that to explain even what is happening today, we need something more than a conspiracy, however cunning and subtle you may suppose it to be, to explain our decline. So let us look for a moment at biology. We all know that this planet has had upon it many more species of life that are now extinct than it has species that survive. We all call to mind some of those species. The dinosaurs once were the mightiest living beings, and for a whole geologic age they ruled the world. But they had a brain the size of a cherry, and they have long been extinct. The dodos, pigeons as big as swans, flourished for millennia on the islands of Mauritius and Reunion, but life was too easy for them. Eventually, there arrived settlers from Europe, bringing with them hogs and rats. The last dodo perished sometime in the 17th century. We are now witnessing a most impressive biological spectacle and lesson. In Africa, the mountain gorilla is rapidly becoming extinct, and some observers believe that there are less than 1,000 of them still alive. They are becoming extinct not because they are hunted by man or by other animals, nor yet because their food supply is vanishing, but simply because the species is losing its vital instincts, its will to live and perpetuate itself. As for pre-human anthropoids, we know that many of them became extinct. The Australopithecus and similar species have certainly vanished. The Sinanthropus is extinct. And, for all practical purposes, so are the Neanderthals. Although, if you walk over a college campus or through a big city these days, you have your doubts. There is no biological reason, you know, why we, the white men of the West, who were the undisputed masters of the whole world a few years ago, may not also become extinct in one way or another. In fact, our extinction is already being discussed in many parts of the world. As you know, Mao Zedong has promised to abolish white men. Mao is the Bolshevik satrap to whom the State Department in Washington delivered China, and whom that same nest keeps in power by protecting him from invasion by the civilized Chinese on Formosa. In India, Krishna Menon has often and rabidly proclaimed his yearning to see white men exterminated, and says that the keystone of his policy is to hasten that glorious day. As you know, American farmers were out this afternoon in their fields working to raise food to keep Krishna Menon and his gang in power in India. But oddly enough, some of the loudest yelps come from persons who look white. Up in Canada, there is a creature called Brock Chisel, who, with the help of Alger Hiss, founded the World Health Organization that is agitating for mental health. Now, Chisholm's big brain just fizzes night and day with mental health. And one of his major worries is how to prevent white men and women from having children so that we can stamp out the white race and have one world. We have in this country an oversized brain named Roderick Seidenberg that has written two books to suggest that it will be easy, by drugs, surgery, and selective breeding, to destroy the human mind completely and make the working population, which of course means us, unconscious. Really unconscious, so that we will work as do ants and termites by reflex action and not even know that we exist. And then, of course, there is the great civil rights movement, which naturally draws its real inspiration from the great and highly successful civil rights movement in Haiti early in the 19th century. In Haiti, as you know, the blacks, instigated and supplied with arms from England and France, systematically butchered all white men, butchered all white children, and eventually butchered all white women, after keeping many of them shut up for a time in pens, for uses which some of you may be able to imagine. That has been the real goal of the civil rights agitators from the first, although many people, deceived by the unctuous cant of ministers, professors, and other agitators, refused to believe it until the cries of kill, Whitey, kill were heard in our riot-torn cities, and the doctrine of extermination was openly preached hour after hour and day after day from powerful radio stations in Cuba. It should be understood that I am not blaming the Negroes in America for the race war that is almost upon us, that will very soon reach the point of no return. The Negroes, from the time of that sinister agitation that began in the early part of this century, have been incited and driven by whites. And a great many intelligent Negroes have striven desperately to avert the catastrophe. I need only mention the late Manning Johnson, who wrote Color, Communism, and Common Sense, and was probably killed for his efforts. And that courageous lady, Julia Brown, whom I'm happy to see with us tonight. And whose book, I Testify, has just come from the press. For a quite different approach, it is odd that many Negroes perceived or sensed the inevitable result of the agitation long before it was glimpsed by white people. Thanks to our controlled press, very few people know that there are now active in the United States at least four organizations of Negroes who are petitioning the United States Senate to pass what is known as the Langer Bill, which provides for assistance to Negroes who desire to return to Africa. There are, I say, at least four such organizations. One is the Peace Movement of Ethiopia, with headquarters in Chicago, whose purpose, as stated on its letterhead, is, quote, to return people of African descent to their motherland, Africa. Others are the African Universal Church, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and the Universal African Nationalist Movement. Now, I do not know the leaders of these organizations, and so I cannot express an opinion about them. But they must represent a considerable segment of the colored population, for in support of the original Langer Bill, they were able to present to the Senate a petition signed by more than 2 million American Negroes who desired repatriation, which they describe, quite properly in historical terms, as the Abraham Lincoln plan. 2 million is a significant number, isn't it? And even more significant is the fact that the very existence of this movement has been so sedulously concealed by our kept press. If we intend to survive ourselves and to have a posterity, we shall have to toughen ourselves intellectually by facing some very unpleasant facts. I know they are unpleasant, and that it would be ever so much nicer if we could pretend that those facts just didn't exist. But I'm going to mention a few of them. They're independent of the international communist conspiracy, in the sense that they would represent for us a terrible danger and deadly menace if, by some divine miracle, every Bolshevik conspirator in the world were vaporized at dawn tomorrow. Everyone has heard of the so-called population explosion. But everyone seems afraid to think about it. The number of human beings, anatomically human at least, is undoubtedly increasing at an appalling rate. The United States is already overpopulated for optimum life, although no critical reduction in our standard of living would be necessary for the better part of a century if our masters permitted us to remain an independent nation. But our increase is nothing compared to the terrible multiplication of the populations of Asia and Africa, caused chiefly by our export to those regions of our medical knowledge, medicines, food, and money. Although we, the world's white and civilized minority, and we are a small minority, We may be able to stave off a crisis for a few decades by working harder and ever harder to support our betters and speed up the rate at which they are breeding. It is perfectly obvious that we, unless we do something unthinkable, must soon be drowned in the flood that we, like the sorcerer's apprentice, started but do not know how to stop. At the present rate, the globe, sometime between 2000 and 2005 AD, that is to say within 40 years, will be infested by 5 billion anatomically human creatures, the maximum number for which food can be supplied by even the most intensive cultivation. And then, just to keep the globe inhabitable at that bare subsistence level, then it will be necessary to kill every year more people than now live in the United States. Kill them with atomic bombs or clubs as may be most convenient. That is the statistically certain future. Some people talk about averting the crisis by preaching methods of birth control, which, if there were no other objection to them, would be about as effective as an effort to bail out the sinking Titanic with a bucket. Other people indulge in pipe dreams about some scientific miracle that will double the known means of producing food and so postpone the crisis for all of 20 years. No one seems willing to stop a moment and think about what is wrong with the statistics. What is wrong, not arithmetically, but humanly wrong. This world is not going to have a population of 5 billion by 2005 AD. It's not going to have that population at any time in the future. Not ever. The one thing that is certain, absolutely certain, is that the population of the world is going to be drastically reduced before the year 2000. The reduction could come through natural causes. There are at least 5 ways, all scientifically possible, in which the world could be partly depopulated in short order by strictly natural forces beyond our control. But if nature does not act, man will. When things became a bit crowded in East Asia, for example, the Huns, and at a later time the Mongols, swept a wide swath through the world as locusts sweep through a wheat field. And wherever they felt the inspiration, they were every bit as efficient as any quantity of hydrogen bombs you could care to imagine. In the natural course of human events, we shall see in the near future wars of extermination on a scale and of an intensity that your mind at present will refuse to contemplate. The only question will be what people will be among the exterminated. If we intend to survive, we shall have to use, and use rationally and willingly, all our great technological genius and all the truly scientific knowledge about the nature of the world that we have been able to attain. I am speaking now about scientific knowledge, not the pseudo-scientific hogwash that is generally used in public schools and colleges to pervert the minds of the young. I shall mention one area that is fundamental to any understanding of human problems, the science of genetics. That, by the way, is the newest of all the scientific disciplines, and this year we should be observing the centennial of its foundation by an obscure, humble, and too modest Augustinian monk, Father Johann Gregor Mendel.
Now, this is another Iron Guard song from the 30s, played and sung in English with an updated score by a Swedish group called Svensk Ungdom, and it's called Son of Romania.
rain has fallen, son. Rest your soul in peace. Your task has just begun. Bury all your pain. It was not in vain. All for us to gain. Your spirit lives through us. Whispers from the earth. Voice of heroic pride. Urging us to keep fighting. I shed my tears no more. For the love you gave, the sacrifice you made. Now rest your soul, we live under your shade. Whispers from the earth, voice of heroic pride. Urging us to keep fighting. Stand united, even if it chose the wrong path. If the Legion will end up in hell, it still will stand united. After successful conquest of hell, the Legion will return victoriously. Unity of steel. Son of Romania, father of the Iron God, the one who gave it all, eternal pride. Showed us through the lies. So you live, so you die. All your spiritual pride will always remember you.
Okay, what with the lengthy, but in my opinion very important, Revelo Oliver cut, we're already running a wee bit short of time this week, so let me give you a few speed emails, kind of like speed dating. Now, Ted from Missouri writes, "Dear Harold, I've just finished reading Freedom's Sons, and I am overwhelmed with joy and sadness because I so badly want to come and live in this beautiful country that you describe." Okay, Ted, come on, what's stopping you? It's right here waiting for you. Nothing illegal about it. You don't have to get a permit like in the old Soviet Union. There's no internal passport system here like there was in the USSR, at least not yet. Although if we wait too long until Hillary's first term, that might change. Of course, there is one slight catch. It's the whole revolution thing. You will actually have to be one of the ones who goes first and makes the beautiful country I describe in Freedom Sons, and there is a wee bit of personal risk and inconvenience involved, plus some commitment of time and effort, but that's what white men do. Real ones, anyway. They don't just sit around, sobbing and wringing their hands about how horrible it all is, and sending each other newspaper articles on the internet about how horrible it all is, and wait for Daddy to come and kiss it better. Ted, not a damn thing is going to happen if you and thousands like you don't get your pale asses up here where you're supposed to be. You're not going to accomplish a damned thing sitting down there in Missouri feeling sorry for yourself, except to end up old and in some state-run fogey farm surrounded by senile people shitting in their diapers and cared for by Mexican orderlies who will cut your throat for your IV. Quit sending me moaning, whinging emails and let me know when you're arriving for your scouting trip and we'll get you set up. And before any of you send me tut-tutting emails telling me I'm being mean to poor Ted and I can catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, I'm not trying to catch flies. I'm trying to change the world. Look, if I had a carrot, I'd use it. If I could offer you people jobs and money and houses to do the right thing, I'd do it, but I can't. I don't have a carrot and all I have is a stick. All I can do when logical persuasion fails is to try and shame you into doing the right thing, for those of you who still have some remnants of a conscience, that is. Okay, this one is from Jared in Michigan. Okay, Harold, calling your bluff. What would it take to create the man on the white horse? Must he come from within the system? Which I think is one reason why people are so fascinated with Ron and Rand Paul. What would it take to make you be the man on the white horse? Okay, I get what you're asking, I think. Jared is referring to the deeply felt desire of white Americans to be rescued from all this mess by a man on a white horse who will draw his saber, flourish it aloft, and yell, "Charge!" on CNN and Fox News, and charge with his little cape flapping in the wind, and make it all good, and make all the bad people go away, just kind of vanish in a puff of smoke, and give all the white folks back their jobs and their split levels in the suburbs and the two cars in the garage and the sizzling barbecue in the backyard. And all these people themselves need to do is watch it on some electronic screen and applaud, and then everything can get back to normal and the whole family can go down to Six Flags for the weekend. I think you more or less get what I'm saying, even if you don't maybe think of it in exactly those terms. White Americans right now are like the niggers in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. They are standing on their rooftops, looking up for someone to come down from the sky and whisk them away. Now, I have told you that, yes, I will be that man on the white horse, if you decide that's what you want. So far, you haven't decided that that's what you want, and so you haven't given me what I need. I need for you to give me the horse. I need for you to give me the saber. I need for you to give me the cape. And finally, I need for you to pack a moving van and come home and live here in the Pacific Northwest, where you're supposed to be. And when the time comes, I need you to charge behind me. I'll strip it down even more for you. I've said before that since the electoral process became completely useless about 60 years ago, there are two ways to bring about change in American society. One is with money, very, very large amounts of money. The other is with a gun. We do not as yet have the physical courage or the basic revolutionary competence to use the gun. Therefore, we have to use money. So that's the first thing I need to become your man on the white horse. I need large, large, very large sums of money, because in this society, money is power. Failing that, I need something that I can transmute into large sums of money. I need publicity for the NF and the Northwest Novels that breaks the blackout and lets millions of white people know that we are here, and brings those white people to northwestfront.org. I need to get copies of the Northwest Novels into the hands of millions of white people. I need hundreds of thousands of listeners to Radio Free Northwest every week so I can stop babbling about crap like this and address serious racial and political issues with serious, non-movement white adults. Now, you asked what it's going to take, Jared? That's what it's going to take. It's going to take you. People keep wondering when I'm going to pull the magic beans out of my pocket. Well, yes, actually, I do have the magic beans. You're the magic beans. First and foremost, I need for you to come home so that we can have this conversation face to face. Secondly, until then, I need you to make better use of your butt-sitting time in front of the computer. Quit looking at porn, quit surfing comic book sites, quit fucking around on Stormfront and VNN so that the secret police pick up on you and start tracking you. Start posting the link to northwestfront.org everywhere you go. Any place, on any site, in any way, shape, or form where you can get away with posting a link, do it. Whoever this is who keeps sweeping the net and expunging all our links, we need to have them all back up within 48 hours. Yeah, Jared, I know I'm raving, but you did ask. I'd like to close the section with a quote from a letter that I got from Bill White a few days ago. Quote, "Our lives are fucked up beyond repair. We can still do one decent thing, and that is to try and save the generations of white children who come after us from our fate." Dear HAC, I write to you because I know the most pressing issue is that of the lack of migrants. I think one of the main reasons people fail to make the migration is because they still think they can lead a perfectly normal life, as in get a job, a family, and pretend that civilization is not crumbling down around them. Although I should not talk, as I did not make the migration yet. Note, the fact that I am 17 is the primary reason. Please tell me your thoughts on this. Yours sincerely, Ontario Pete. Yeah, Pete, you're right. In a way, it's pathetic. There are still untold numbers of white people in this country who cling to the American dream, or I guess it's the Canadian dream in your case. In some instances, I'm sure it's the traditional American dream, the middle-class house with the white picket fence and the sane, stable nuclear family, and the good-paying job which allows you to raise that family and send the kids to college and then spend your golden years riding around in a beautiful, clean America in an RV and seeing all kinds of places, yada, 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 yada. Or then there's the millennial American dream, which is promised to young white people, especially white boys, by the entertainment industry and TV and movies and graphic novels, i.e. comic books. That's the American dream of a perpetual adolescence, where you get to spend your life snowboarding in Aspen or bungee jumping or riding around in a van with a hot chick solving mysteries or riding around the countryside with your bro fighting demons and vampires like in Supernatural. Or basically a kind of an animal house existence, living in your parents' basement until you're 40 and then inheriting the whole house when they kick it, a life of part-time jobs and perpetual keggers and casual sexual encounters and hot cars and irresponsibility. I've mentioned the meeting that we had down in Oregon last weekend, and one of the comrades I met there put it in a way I'd never heard before. He said, "The American dream for white boys is now to die as an 85-year-old teenager." Guys, it is time for all of you to grow up and stop expecting me to do all this for you. You will not have your weird American fantasy about whatever it is. You are headed for a life that is unimaginably hideous. I have told you what to do about it. I will continue to tell you what to do about it. For God's sake, do it. Come home. Pete, I wish I had better news for you. I really do. I really wish I had better news for all of you. And I won't get into my reincarnation kick again, except to remind you that in your long cycle of existences on Earth, you will have lives where you are free to live for yourself. Lives which are kind of like vacations, where you can indulge in hedonism and sensuality or wild, exciting adventures just for the hell of it, or just plain kick back and spend a nice, quiet, prosperous life full of love and contentment and tranquility. Yeah, you do get cosmic vacation time like that. It's part of the overall karmic package. But this life we're in now is not a vacation day, it's a work day, and we're on a deadline. Pete, being Canadian, we could use you here, but what with the immigration situation when college or job time comes, try to head for British Columbia or Alberta. They're going to be part of the Northwest homeland too one day. Read Freedom Sons to see how that might come about. Okay, I've got some more Romanian Iron Guard music this guy sent me, but I think people might be a little bored with that now, so here's Alan Price.
If you have a friend on whom you think you can rely, you are a lucky man. If you found the reason to live on and not to die, you are a lucky man. Preachers and poets. poets and scholars don't know you. Temples and statues and steeples won't show you. If you've got the secret, just try not to blow it. Stay a lucky man, a lucky man. If you found the meaning of the truth in this whole world, you are a lucky man. If knowledge hangs around your neck like pearls instead of chains, you are a lucky man.
Ended up this week with some more commentary on the Northwest Republic's draft constitution. Now, this is from someone who calls himself Supply Scout. Dear HAC, I've been listening to RFN, working through various podcasts, and reading the draft constitution, and I have several questions. I'll begin with my first one so as not to slam you with so many at once. Section 2, Article 2, Subsection 1 and 2. In reading this, I believe that I'm correct in that there will be no state governments of Washington, Idaho, Oregon, etc. There will only be the central state authority of the NAR, and below that there shall exist counties and municipalities. As a segue, my reading of the two subsections was at first glance thought to be contradictory, but on second reading I realized that Section 1 referred to the abolition of the rules, ordinances, departments, etc. of local governments and not the actual boundaries and entities themselves. I look forward to your response, and I will be posting more questions, and looking forward to some of them perhaps being answered on RFN. Signed, Supply Scout. Not totally sure what the question is there, but yes, while the states like Washington and Montana will continue to exist in people's minds as geographical expressions, just like Italy and Germany and India were for so many centuries, in a small country like the Northwest Republic, or at least comparatively much smaller country, there's no need for excessively complex structures of government. The Republic will have, or is intended by the Constitution to have, the smallest government possible, and that means eliminating as many government offices and branches as possible, and keeping only what is needed in that it has some kind of actual function. If we have state governments, then that's going to be more elected officials and more bureaucracy, and more taxpayers' money consumed to pay those bureaucrats. We don't need it. The most efficient kind of government is always the one with the least number possible of layers or relays between the man in the street and the man at the top. Now, in the Republic, there will be four layers, depending on whether you go via the judicial or legislative or administrative route. Between the Northwest, Joe Sixpack on a street, and the state president, judicially it will go judge, appeals court judge, minister of justice to the president. Legislatively, it will be National Convention Deputy to Committee Chairperson, depending on what the problem of the issue is, to Speaker of the Convention, to President. Administratively, it will go County Commissioner or Mayor to County Sheriff to Minister of the Interior or some other Cabinet Minister, again, depending on what the problem or the issue is, to President. That's four layers. Now, God knows how many layers there are in the United States at this time. I don't even know if it's possible to quantify them. Okay, back to Supply Scout. Thanks for the response. Now on to question two. If the Northwest Front is a one-party system and the NAR will be unicameral in nature, I assume you mean the National Convention, then why the need for an opposition party? My assumption is that this would be to keep a balance and let dissenting voices be heard, hence the once-per-month day of allowing such a party to have a voice in the National Convention, but since I have no real experience with such an idea, I would love some in-depth explanation. Well, Supply Scout, if you don't have any experience with that idea, you need to find one of these cable channels, I can't remember the name of them if you've got cable TV, that broadcasts Question Time in the British Parliament, and you'll get some idea of what I mean. Now, the purpose of the parliamentary opposition in the Northwest Republic is just that, to oppose. David Lane referred to the opposition as the people's defense attorneys. Someone else called them tribunes of the people in the ancient Roman sense. The purpose of the party and the government is to govern. The purpose of the opposition is to keep the party and the government honest through absolute parliamentary immunity, just as the persons of the tribunes in Rome were inviolate, and also through Question Time, which is constitutionally mandated at least once a month, if memory serves, and in which everybody from the president on down who is summoned must show up and publicly answer questions about their conduct of public affairs. Now, some parliamentary committees will necessarily have a preponderance of government members, but I believe we need something similar to an Inspector General's office or anti-corruption committee to ride herd on the party and prevent us from becoming lazy, corrupt, and tyrannical, which has a tendency to occur with people in power. Remember that old saying about how power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? We don't want that to happen in our republic. We need the opposition as a public conscience for the revolution and to submit everything the government does to searching public scrutiny. Obviously, this is going to take a lot of working out as to details when the time comes, but basically the opposition in the National Convention will stand looking over the party's shoulder and make damn sure that we do not betray our roots and our basic principles, as so often occurs under democracy when people start wheeling and dealing and horse trading. I personally feel that the opposition needs to be comprised not just of general malcontents and former unionists, which we're probably going to get a lot of the leanest, meanest, most fanatical and puritanical of our own kind that we can persuade to run, to keep us on the straight and narrow. Back to Supply Scout. Gonna throw out question number 3-2, since the homeland will be open to all whites and the NFNAR will allow freedom of religion, how will a community of Amish be dealt with when it comes to the requirement for military service? Would they be exempt even though able-bodied and thus automatically be given the community state service option? Basically, I see the NAR as not allowing whole communities to declare themselves not a part of that society, but wonder if they moved en masse to the NAR due to conditions in their traditional area, how they would be treated. I see nothing in the draft constitution which would allow or prevent either situation and would love to hear your thoughts on this. Okay. That's kind of a crystal ball type thing, and we're getting to the point where I'm kind of sitting here dreaming about what I would do if I were king, which I ain't going to be. All I can say on that is that we'll have to see what transpires and how many Amish we have to deal with. Now, I will say that I am against the state banning any religion except for Zionism, which isn't a religion at all, but a political ideology, nor am I in favor of any kind of official state position on what religion is true or not. But everybody will have to be judged on individual behavior in individual instances. I personally would not object to some arrangement whereby Amish boys can be medics or ambulance drivers in the army, as was the case during both world wars, but that's not my department. I very much doubt that by the time that issue comes up in real life, I'm going to be around to venture an opinion. My time will be up by then, just as our time is up now. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.